Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Greetings, dear listeners. Daniel here. Our next episode that you're about to listen to is a bit of a departure. I know that we said we were going to start Lyrical Ballads by Coleridge and Wordsworth, but it turns out that I needed a little bit of remedial education in poetics. So Claude, of course, being the helpful instructor that he is, takes us on a guided tour of poetry, of meter, of poetic elements, just everything that you're looking for when you're reading poetry, how to read a poem. It was very enlightening for me. Hopefully it will be for you guys as well. Also want to mention that The Cannonball is a proud member of the Agora Podcast Network. And this month we are featuring a terrific podcast, the French History Podcast. This is a magisterial survey beginning all the way back 1500 years ago with the establishment of the Kingdom of the Franks in what had formerly been Roman Gaul, and taking it all the way up to the 20th century, from Clovis to Clemenceau, one might say. Interspersed in these, in the long narrative are special episodes of all sorts of topics drawn from French history and culture. It's really a wonderful show. I just finished listening to the series on the Merovingian dynasty, the Dark Ages, Frankish kings, and learned a lot. It's a subject that I thought I had a pretty good grip on, but, I learned a lot and it was a lot of fun. So please check out The French History Podcast on the Agora Podcast Network, and also check out all of our other sister shows on Agora Podcast Network, available wherever you find fine podcasts like the one you're about to listen to now.
Hello and welcome to The Cannonball, a podcast attempt to read all of the books in Harold Bloom's list of the Western canon. This is Claude Myron Guzer with Daniel Doherty. As always, how you doing, Daniel?
Hey, I'm good, aside from the technical difficulties we were just going over before recording. But of course, you're all hearing me coming through crystal clear, beautifully. Let it never be said that we cannot, like so many inventive crewmen upon the USS Enterprise invent a solution when all seems lost. Thank you and good night.
Exactly.
Wait, no, we're not done. Okay.
All right. So this is a very special episode. We figured since we've launched into Lyrical Ballads and we're going to be poetry heavy for, you know, a couple of episodes, we figured we'd give the listeners a sort of crash course in poetry and poetics. By no means is this a sort of end-all be-all for all things poetic. This is just sort of, here's how some of the terminology works. Here's some of the ideas that go into it. Here's a little bit about form and what it means for the time period, that sort of thing.
And Claude is being very polite by saying that this is for the listener. This is in large part also for me, because I think we've definitely talked on the show before. Like, poetry is a realm of human endeavor that I really don't have a deep familiarity with, aside from you know, poems I've read for the show and, you know, occasional poems assigned in school and everything. But I'm pretty much out to sea. So I'm really looking forward to this. This is going to be good to get all kinds of new tools in my toolkit to take into lyrical ballads.
Well, I think there are two things that kind of get in the way of feeling comfortable reading a poem. One is the technical terminology, like the technical vocabulary and the sort of technical aspects of the poem itself. That can be kind of daunting if you don't know a whole lot, but if you just listen to it, you can kind of get it without necessarily having to know all this stuff. And the other thing is that poetry is, for whatever reason, it seems to be sort of, how do I put this? Always aware of the history of form, always aware of the history of subject and metaphor, and continually playing with form and metaphor with that history in mind, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So if a poet is sort of – a poet can make an allusion with form. A poet can make an allusion with rhyme and kind of riff on something that might be known to other poets but might not be known outside of people familiar with, say, you know, the writings of Ben Jonson or Andrew mm-hmm. Marvell's, you know, Carpe Diem poem or something like that. So it's the technical – I guess the technical know-how combined with the sort of general history of the form that you kind of need to know, right? And unless you've spent years and years studying that, you might not know it. And it can be, you know, kind of a barrier for entry.
Yeah.
The other thing that I think gets in the way is your high school English teacher makes you feel as if you don't understand what you're talking about. You know, this is the thing that I always have to tell my students. There's no hidden meaning. You know, the way I like to think about it is in Samuel Beckett's novel, Watt, at the end, he has this list of things that how does he put it? It's a list of things that weren't put into the novel but intended to be put into the novel.
Yeah.
And there's a note at the end that says only exhaustion and disgust prevented the author from incorporating the following material. So it's kind of like an errata for his own novel. And the last one, it's like footnotes to all kinds of bizarre things. and the last note says no symbols where none intended.
Yeah.
And that's how I like to think about it. A lot of times our training in poetry and poetics, like going back to high school or middle school, it's sort of trying to train you to believe that there's more to it than there actually is a lot of times.
Yeah.
And that introduction to the technicalities can quickly become X is symbolic for Y, Z is symbolic for A, something like that, where you're stretching to make meaning of the thing when really, you know, just what is the message? What is it saying, right? What is the kind of rhetorical argument going on, you know, aside from the technicalities, aside yeah. from the symbol, aside from the metaphor, aside from the simile. So there's this desire that I think is sometimes encouraged to jump straight into these abstract meanings that are not necessarily specifically there on the page. So I guess that's my long ramble to get us into why people, you know, come to my class and say, well, poetry sucks. Well, you've been trained to approach it in a particular way. You've been trained to think about it in a particular context. And I think the context is preventing you from really engaging, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So does that sort of hew to your experience of learning this stuff?
It does. It absolutely does. I think in my experience with poetry, the pedagogical take was leaned very heavily on identify the themes. And engagement, and you know, it never really flipped a switch for me, which is, I think there has to be some kind of great disconnect, of course, because like, I mean, it's probably different now. What with their Roblox and what have you? I don't know if teens listen to music anymore, but you know, when you're a teenager and you're listening to pop music, you know, the dominant form of poetry of our time. And especially if you're a fan of hip hop, I mean, come on, like that's, you know, you're steeped in poetry, absolutely steeped in poetry.
Yeah.
And appreciate it and can draw meaning out of it independently. You know, I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, clearly there's something, you know, kind of going askew in the whole operation. But I am, as always, ready to just completely rinse my brain clean and all right. And be born again.
So I guess the place to start, and I apologize for the inelegance of my initiatory ramble. I'm trying to sort of bring several thoughts together at once. But I guess the place that I always like to start is the language itself, and English is a terrible language.
and we love it, folks. We love it for its terribleness.
Yeah, I think I've ranted about it on here before, but it really is a couple of different linguistic systems crammed together to make a language.
Yeah,
right. A lot of its base is Germanic, with all of these Latinate inflections.
Yeah.
And so basically that's sort of saying, I guess that's a reason why when you're taught grammar in high school or elementary school or wherever it is that you learn grammar, if people still learn grammar, there's always this list. It's like, okay, so here are the rules and here are the 25 exceptions to each individual rule. And the reason why is because you've got like competing linguistic systems crammed together. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's a historical reason for that I won't get into right now.
Because lest we really be here all night. Yeah. And I have to wrestle but with my complicated admiration for John McWhorter as a linguist and writer. Anyway.
But anyway, so to get back to it though, so it's a tough language for poetry, mostly because of the rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
Germanic languages tend to have difficulty with rhyme, which isn't to say that Northern European languages, you know, have never rhymed before. But it's just sort of difficult because the vocabulary itself, like the diction itself, doesn't quite lend itself to rhyme as easily
mm-hmm.
as something like, say, Spanish or Italian or French.
Yeah, yeah.
Latinate languages that have a sort of clear masculine, clear feminine with sounds that designate those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
The gender of the noun. So it's just this kind of weird hodgepodge language, but what it does have is a syllabic base.
Yes.
Right? And that's going to be the root of poetry. You have to count the syllables and you have to figure out where the syllables are, where the syllables are placed, and, you know, when and where they operate. So, I guess, this is sort of an aside, while we're talking about rhyme. We brought this up in Milton, but you know that the old Greek and Latin epics didn't rhyme, right?
Yes, yes. But yeah, and it was a purely rhythmic meter and poetic kind of conception.
Yeah, there you go. So that's a kind of parallel system, as far as I can understand it, where you're sort of placing this emphasis on syllables and syllabic construction. All right. So what you do in English that's really, really important is count the syllables. And there's this thing you can do, which is scan a poem. And when you're scanning a poem, you're breaking a line down into its syllabic components. You're looking for the unstressed syllables and you're looking for the stressed syllables. And anywhere that you find an unstressed syllable, you put this little U over it, and any place that you find a stressed syllable, you put this accent mark over it. I wish I had a visual component here, but that's really sort of how it goes. And so the first thing you do when you're looking at a poem is, well, you read it and you think about the meaning of it. What is the message of this poem? Literally, what is the poem saying? And then you can dig in and start messing around with the metrics. All right. So the meter is the sort of repeated measurable pattern. Okay.
Yeah.
The basic, I guess, unit of measurement for a line is called a foot. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole thousand-year history of writers in English messing with the, you know, punning on the idea of the foot. So don't think you're being original there with whatever silly dad joke is swirling around in your head. It's been made by silly dads going back, you know, several hundred years. But the foot is the basic unit of measurement of a palm. And what you do to come up with the type of palm is you count the feet and then you describe the feet. Mm-hmm. So you count the number of feet and then you tell what kind of feet they are. All right. And there are a couple of different kinds of feet. There are a couple of different kinds of units of measurement of the palm. And the units of measurement of the palm sort of depend on whether the syllables within the foot are stressed or unstressed and how they're stressed and unstressed. Okay. This is all very abstract, but let me give you an example. The one that most people, I think, would be familiar with is the I am, because everybody has read some Shakespeare, and Shakespeare wrote in – what do you write in, Daniel?
Iambic pentameter, also known as blank – also known as blank verse. Right?
There you go.
All right, good.
Exactly. I can hear the sort of tentative sound in your voice. No, but that's
okay. Yeah, the beads of sweat were forming on my forehead. Yeah.
So and I am all right, basically what's that means? Pentameter, what does penta mean?
So that's five. That'd be units of five, I suppose, in the prefix conception. For five. Yeah.
So how many feet are in a pentameter line?
Five feet then.
5 feet in a pentameter line.
Yeah.
So if it's iambic pentameter, what kind of foot is it?
It would be an iamb.
There you go.
Ah,
now, what's an iamb? It's two syllables, unstressed, stressed.
Now, before we go much further, I'm sure our audience is a little curious. Are there any, what are some other sort of foots or feet that we might encounter in English poetry? I mean, we all know the term iambic pentameter and, you know, and by extension iambs, but what other kind of feet might we encounter?
Oh, okay. So I've got a whole list of them.
Oh, great. Right.
I wanted to start with the iamb because it really is sort of the most common. And for reason, English verse tends to sort of lapse into iambs. I mean, sometimes poets will try not to write in iambs and inadvertently just keep going into iamb. It's just this weird kind of rhythm that you can get into. But you have other kinds of feet that sort of crop in there. You've got the trochee, which is sort of like the reverse of the iamb. It's a foot where you have a stressed syllable and then an unstressed syllable. Mm-hmm. And do you want to hear a poem that's really oddly jagged and jittery because it's written in trochees? This is one that's probably well known to most people. Daniel, I think you'll know it. Mm-hmm. You ready?
Yeah.
Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. To some visitor, I muttered, tapping at my chamber door, only this and nothing more. That's Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven.
Yeah.
What makes it so weird? Like, what makes it so, like, I don't know, choppy, I guess is the best way that I can think to put it at this late an hour in the evening. Is because the stress is on the first syllable, once upon a midnight dreary, right?
Yeah.
You've got this intensity straight from the beginning, and then it just sort of chugs along like that.
I was going to say it ends up with an effect that's the like I would call it sing-songy, but wrong.
Yeah. Well, Poe was doing that on purpose. I mean, you know, we sort of had our weird one-off Poe episode, but Poe, for all of his faults as a poet, and he had many, most of them were in terms of his subject matter. But for all of his faults as a poet, he really did pay close attention to the meter. And that's the thing that you can say about him is that he was very cunning in how he would use the meter. And yeah. he would often purposefully go for an effect. And he could kind of sort of pull it off. The problem is a lot of the subject matter is either the same thing over and over again, or it gets really trite really quickly, or it just sort of hits you over the head and you're like, oh, come on, man. But anyway, that's – the trochee is another foot that you can use. And I think as you can hear, it's just kind of jagged. It's off, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But you can the thing about the thing about a verse form, the thing about a meter, is that you can substitute feet. So even if something is primarily iambic pentameter, you can throw in a trochee there just to sort of pop it up a little bit, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's some other feet that you can play with too. You can throw in an anapest, which is three syllables, two unstressed syllables and one stressed syllable. You can throw in a spondi, which is two successive syllables. Wait a minute. I can't read my own handwriting. it's two successive syllables that are both stressed. I'm sorry. I'm fumbling over myself here. So it's sort of like two stressed syllables.
Yeah.
And then you have a pyrrhic, which is two successive unstressed syllables. So the spondi is two stressed syllables and the pyrrhic is two unstressed syllables. So you see, you can throw in a couple things here and there to vary it up and to make it not sound robotic or sing-songy or, you know, Mother Goosey or what have you.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so if you know what you're doing, you can kind of like play around with the meter. So even though you have a particular meter, you have a particular form that you're working in, if you vary it, you're not wrecking the form. You're not wrecking the meter. You're just varying it to make it interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. So are you with me so far?
I'm right there with you. This is great.
Okay. So those are the kind of feet that you can have, or a couple of different kinds. And like I said, this is like just scratching the surface here of what you can do with this. All right. So the next step is to count the feet. And we already did that with iambic pentameter. If the iamb is the kind of foot, pentameter is the number of feet in the line. Mm-hmm. So you have 5 feet in the line, iambic pentameter. If you have a 3 foot line, it's trimeter. If you have a 4 foot line, it's tetrameter. 5 foot pentameter. 6 foot hexameter. Mm-hmm. And so on. Okay. So that's how you determine the meter. So far, so good. Now, the stanza is sort of like the basic unit of the poem. It's sort of like the paragraph of the poem. And this kind of goes back and forth. When you get to the 20th century, sometimes you have a verse paragraph or a sort of that's a weird kind of chunk of text, which doesn't necessarily have a repeatable form within it.
Yeah.
But the stanza that gets really, really weird and can kind of dovetail with the stanza anyway. And I'm sort of getting lost in the woods. So if anybody ever asks you, just say stanza.
That's right.
my cop out there. But the stanza is sort of like the basic unit. And most poetry until the 20th century was primarily built around the stanza. Or I guess this is the general cliche. Mm-hmm. And what the modernists really did, because they were approaching it as a visual text more than a sort of heard text, is changed it so that the line becomes the sort of unit of the poem.
Yeah.
That's sort of back and forth depending on what you want to do with the poem and what kind of poem that you're trying to write. You know, plenty of people are still writing sonnets. Plenty of people are still writing odes and ballads, mm-hmm. right, in various ways, shapes, and forms. So you can pay attention to one, you can pay attention to the other, you can throw it together. It depends if you're writing free verse or formal verse or how you're approaching it. But I'm just sort of giving you the catch-alls here. All right. So rhyme. Here's the sort of technical stuff that no one pays attention to with rhyme. You can have masculine rhyme where the stress is on the rhyming word, right? Like on the end of the word that rhymes so that the end of the line is stressed to emphasize the rhyme. Then you have feminine rhyme where the rhyme is unstressed at the end of the word. And if you're reading a lot of 18th century poetry, something like Alexander Pope, Pope would be really sort of fascinated with these things and would play around with masculine and feminine rhyme for all kinds of technical reasons, sometimes just to show off. Dryden would do some of the same. I think Johnson was sort of in that vein, but it was something that I think if you're being extraordinarily technical with, then you're going to want to pay, you know, more attention to. But if you're just reading it for fun, sort of like we're doing, that doesn't really come into it at all. And I just threw it in there because it was some interesting vocabulary. But the thing about rhyme is you look at the rhyme, you see what rhymes, and you sort of line it up by letter. So if the first line rhymes with the third line and the second line rhymes with the fourth line, then you would say A-B-A-B rhyme.
Yeah.
Okay. So I hope everybody remembers that from middle school or high school or whenever you were taught those.
Yeah.
But you use letters to kind of delineate the rhyme. So you can say A-B-A-B, C-D-C-D, so on and so forth. I almost got myself into a sonnet form there. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But anyway... So rhyme, there's a great sort of innovation. I guess it's not an innovation that was developed in the 20th century, but sort of utilized in the 20th century, which is near rhyme or slant rhyme. Near rhyme, slant rhyme, they both basically mean the same thing. You can have a consonant that's the same or a vowel sound that's the same, something that suggests rhyme that doesn't have to be sort of straight up fire, desire, or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Which, is again fire and desire for 1,000 years.
Which is, again, something anyone who has listened to pop music would be very familiar with. I think that happens a lot.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, you can play around with it. And the great thing about rhyme is that you can suggest connection between words and you can draw out connections between words. And if you're using near rhyme or slant rhyme, you can do something of the same to sort of cast them in a sort of similar light, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a kind of cool way to be thinking about how words sound, why words sound, so on and so forth. And there's one more rhyme that I want to talk about, which is internal rhyme, where the rhyme will sort of take place in the middle of the line instead of at the end. So it's rhyme that doesn't necessarily occur at the end of the line. And if you want to see a great version of this, Henri Cole, you know, I'll see if I can link it in the show notes. I might not be able to, but Henri Cole did a poem called The Roman Bath at Nimes, where he's deliberately playing with instopped lines and enjambment and slant rhyme and internal rhyme. To sort of make this rhetorical case about, I guess, why we should embrace certain kinds of pleasures of the body in the face of mortality. And so it's really fun, and I'll pull that up later. All right. So are you following me so far?
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
Okay. Here we go. When we talk about form, you're talking about a repeated or repeatable rhythm and rhyme, a sort of repeatable meter in rhyme. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a particular kind of line put together in particular kinds of ways, with a particular kind of rhyme going with it. All right.
Yeah.
So the form that I thought we might could start with, because it's going to be so – it's going to be something that Wordsworth is going to come back to a lot throughout the lyrical ballads is the ballad.
Yeah, yeah.
It's in the damn title.
Fittingly enough.
All right. So a ballad, it's a quatrain, which means it's a four-line stanza. And excuse me, the rhyme is either A B C B or A B A B. And there are a couple of versions of the ballad. You can have iambic tetrameter, followed by a trimeter, followed by tetrameter, followed by trimeter, which would basically go something like da 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 da. It has that weird kind of galloping mother goose sound to it.
Sure.
There's a variation on it where you can do tetrameter, 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 trimeter, or trimeter, where it's da 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 da, and sort of like falls off. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's associated in English with a kind of folk tradition. That's why Wordsworth was coming to it. That's why he wanted to use it. That's why they wanted to use this idea of the ballad in the title, was to connect it to an English folk tradition in opposition to what they saw as a sort of overpolished professional verse, even though Wordsworth's whole plan was to set himself up as a professional poet. But it's trying to shift the focus into a different kind of writing, right?
Yeah.
And we were also sort of talking about how that was read politically in the time. Because they were utilizing certain kinds of form, they were setting themselves up to be read as certain kinds of political poets, right?
Yeah.
So form carries a kind of politic with it. Now, the ballad typically has some kind of narrative push to it.
Hmm.
If you want to read an old Scots ballad, you can check out The Ballad of Sir Patrick Spence, which is about this valiant knight who dies at sea.
Hmm.
The end.
Yeah.
It's it has this way of telling a story, a very brief story, in a kind of compact sort of way, and it speeds along and you move right through it. So it's a kind of versatile verse form, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of tell a simple tale with it. Wordsworth is going to do that. But it's sort of easy and quick, and you're done. Mm-hmm. And you'll kind of be amazed. Words will throw some of these things in there, particularly the Lucy poems, which I guess we'll talk about next time, where, you know, what's the story? There was a girl no one knew, and she died, and I miss her. The end. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can just kind of tell it. So I wanted to start with that. Because that's going to be one of the things that connects our romantics to that kind of English tradition. Now, one more time, when we're talking about tradition and we're talking about folk traditions, we have to keep in mind, you know, we have to keep a certain kind of skepticism, right? That part of what these guys are trying to do is co-opt some of that, reinvent it. We're not talking about something that's like a tradition that's static, because no tradition is ever static.
Yeah.
Though at times, perhaps some of the romantics want to claim that this tradition is static and that they're recovering it in some ways. So, you know, there are all kinds of caveats going along with that, but that's sort of why I wanted to start with the ballad. All right.
Yeah.
So have you ever read a sonnet, Daniel?
I have. That would have been part of my Shakespeare curriculum. And I do recall that I have definitely read a couple of Shakespeare's sonnets. I know. Oh, John Donne. He wrote in sonnets. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And I know. So I know I've read some Donne as well.
yeah. Late in his life. He was relatively young when he died, but late in his life, after he'd become a Church of England clergyman, mm-hmm. John Donne turned to writing holy sonnets. Okay, let's talk about Donne for 5 seconds, just because I'm fascinated by him.
All right.
What the hell? Now, Donne, if anybody is interested in poetry, poetics, and hasn't sort of encountered Donne, please go do so now. He's a lot of fun. He was born to a Catholic family in England in the 17th. Is it? Well, he was writing in the 17th century. I get my dates always confused. But he, you know, if you were from a Catholic family, you could attend university, but you couldn't take a degree. You couldn't live within the city limits. You couldn't take certain kinds of official positions. He was a smart kid, and he was kind of the reputation is that he was sort of wild and crazy in his late teens, early 20s. Then he got married in secret. He sort of eloped with his employer's daughter. And that landed him in jail for a night, I believe. At least that's a legend. And he had a sort of rough scramble to find employment. He worked as a sort of official secretary or cleric for a bit. He was an ambassador's secretary, I believe. And so he was always going to the continent. but he was trained more or less as a lawyer. And because he was raised Catholic, he had to always be constantly aware of like what was blasphemous and what was not, what was heretical and what was not. And at a certain point, this is something that was told to me by a professor that I've never verified with an actual look at the biography, but he apparently was sort of freelance scanning ministers' sermons to make sure that they weren't inadvertently committing heresies. it's I guess it's sort of like due diligence for clergymen, which sounds kind of silly, but remember, Church of England positions, that's a political position. And if you say something that inadvertently goes too far Catholic or too far like Protestant, then off with your head.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause anyway, you're the Anglican Church trying, you know, you're hitting that sweet spot of a high church and, you know, Episcopal structure with bishops and whatnot. So that, you know, you're opposed to the Catholics, but also these rotten nonconformers who are getting really too Protestant with it, with their presbyters and whatnot.
So you gotta find a middle road. Anyway, in his youth, he wrote a lot of, I guess, poems for occasion, songs, poems to be passed around, I guess they would have been considered diversions. I mean, just kind of like the fun part of writing a poem. And he will take his analogies to the furthest possible place. Let's put it that way. Where any other poet would have sort of tossed off a metaphor, he'll extend the metaphor across the poem to take it as far as he can possibly go. It's really sort of astounding to see. But late in his life, his wife died. He was sort of living, I believe, north of London. He was still sort of cobbling together an existence, and he was well known as someone who was.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Apt at clergy stuff, I guess that's the way to put it. And so he was sort of persuaded to join the clergy and became an extraordinarily popular preacher. And later he wrote Holy Sonnets, which are sonnets to God, essentially. Mm-hmm. So the sonnet, that's a sort of roundabout way to get us to the sonnet. The sonnet is this form. It's 14 lines of iambic pentameter, and it was really sort of developed by Petrarch, the Tuscan language poet, mm-hmm. who, you know, Tuscan language, which, as we said in Dante, becomes Italian. He sort of took parts of the classical mode and merged it with parts of the kind of street music he was hearing around to try to create this elevated form. Mm-hmm. But the Petrarchan sonnet, it has an octave and a sestet. So it has 8 lines and then 6 lines. And between those, there's a volta or a turn. That's mm-hmm. sort of typically what happens in a sonnet. You get through a certain part of the poem, and then there will be a turn, like conceptually within the poem, as if an argument is being made. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing about the sonnet. In Petrarch, I mean, he uses it as a love poem, essentially. And it has this kind of reputation for love poetry.
Yeah.
But at its heart, it's really openly rhetorical.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's a very argument heavy poem. But the the Petrarchan sonnet starts with this octave, which goes ABBA, ABBA, and then you've got a sestet, which can go CDC, CDCDCD, or CDECDE. So you can vary the sestet. But you see why English language poets would be fascinated by this rhetorical form and yet maybe hesitant to adopt a form that really only has 2 rhymes.
Oh, yeah.
that's tough.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's a variation in English, which is called Shakespearean, but which was really sort of developed by Wyatt and Surrey, who are precursors to Shakespeare. Shakespeare, I guess, sort of popularized this or used this the most. It's 14 lines, 3 quatrains. So basically you've got 3 sections of 4 lines, and then you throw a couplet on the end. So it's A, B, A, B, C, D, C, D, E, F, E, F, G, G. memorize it and spout it off. But wait, what that really sort of does is extends the argument, but you get this nice little couplet to bring it to a solid conclusion. And you can kind of show off with that last couplet, which is what Shakespeare does a lot of times. Hmm. So it begins as this love poem, but it's got this real sort of rhetorical push in it. And it's interesting. All right. By the time Shakespeare gets his hands on the sonnet, it's already kind of a cliched form.
Yeah.
And if you actually read his sonnets, most of the time they're anti-sonnets. He's taking the tropes that he's inherited, just saying, yeah, that's bullshit. Yeah, that's bullshit. Yeah, that's bullshit. Watch what I can do.
Yeah.
A lot of times he's hyper aware of all of that stuff, and he's kind of turning it on its head in some fun and playful ways. What's interesting when you get to the 19th century is that Wordsworth, Shelley, and a couple of others that I can think of will use the sonnet, but not necessarily in its sort of love poem form. Keats does a couple in that mode. Mm-hmm. But Wordsworth is going to write some sonnets that are a little bit more social critique or political. And I guess the most famous sonnet out of the Romantic era would be Shelley's Ozymandias, this critique of absolute tyranny and absolute power and monarchical tyranny. So it strikes me that, you know, at least for the ones that I can think of off the top of my head, the Romantics were interested in sort of reestablishing this kind of rhetorical push within the sonnet, which is kind of ironic because the Romantics, as we'll probably talk about next time, are sort of notorious, at least amongst 20th century critics, for burying their rhetorical aims. Mm-hmm. Or so 20th century critics claim. I think 20th century critics are maybe blind to the genres that they were playing in, but we can talk about that later. Anyway, so that's the sonnet. So we've got the ballad, we've got the sonnet, and then the most frustrating one of all, the ode.
Hmm. Yeah.
Ask me what the sort of generic form of the ode is.
I would have no clue because I only know the word ode from the standpoint of like the kind of subject matter. Or rather the approach to the subject matter being, you know, well, an ode, like in celebration of or in some manner. I have no clue what the actual form of the poem might be.
Me fucking either. Okay.
All right.
It's something that's bothered me. I'm sorry. I'm being a little silly here. No, you're right. It's a really weird form because it really sort of does take its cues from the subject matter. As you said, public celebration, right? Mm-hmm. It goes back to the Greek. You've got the Pindaric ode. Pindar was a dude who was basically paid by wealthy families to write, you know, beautiful songs about their heroic sons who came in first in the Olympics. And if they didn't come in first, then it was make our idiot bastard son who came in fifth look good. you know, things like that. But it was meant to be sung, and it was a public performance for celebration, and typically the Pindaric odes are celebrations of specific athletes in the Olympic Games. You have the Horatian ode after Horace, where it's a little bit more philosophical in mode. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Sapphic ode, which is this sort of elaborate scheme based on, I believe, what we think Sappho was writing. That I'm not going to get into the details, but I believe it was brought back into the consciousness or attempted to be brought back into the consciousness by a certain English decadence in the late 19th century. I think Swinburne tried to play around with sapphic odes and maybe Rossetti. I'm not quite sure. I believe Swinburne did. But anyway, it's sort of in imitation of an idea of Greece. All right. So, excuse me. The ode is going to be important for the Romantics, and we're going to see a lot of odes. Well, we're going to see several odes in the lyrical ballads, and Keats' whole career is based around his odes. And the thing about the ode that I think is appealing to the early 19th century is the fact that it doesn't have a really set form. A lot of times it's really just up to the poet to determine the form. So you get to make the stanza, you get to make the rhyme scheme, you get to make the meter, like figure it out, put it together.
Yeah.
There you go. But it does have certain kinds of, I guess, structural supports. If you want to use it in a particular way, you can use it like strophe, antistrophe, and epode. Drawing your cues from the sort of classical Greek tragedy, right? The chorus would come on and do a little bit of song and dance, and they'd move across the stage in one direction for the strophe. They'd move across the stage in another direction for the antistrophe, and then come out to the center and sort of twirl around for the epode. Okay, not exactly twirl around, but you get the idea. But this means that the ode can kind of open itself up to a sort of dialectical reading where a stanza can rethink a previous position or a previous stanza. You'll see that a lot in – well, you'll see that in Wordsworth's Intimations of Immortality ode. I mean, that's the whole engine of the Ode to the Nightingale, where the speaker is trying to think and rethink – their own experience of hearing the bird's song. Like, how do I interpret this? How do I understand this? And it's sort of like thinking again and again, sort of countering that thought, then countering that thought, then countering that thought. So it's a form that emphasizes individuality, the individuality of the artist.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that the Romantics are sort of drawn to it. If the artist is supposed to be singular and be possessed of this kind of singular talent or singular ability, then the ode expresses that, right? The form allows you to express that. And excuse me. Yeah, so I think that's all I want to say about the ode. Now, you have a couple of other things thrown in there, which we're going to talk about next time. A lot of what I'm doing here is setting up some of the formal stuff that we'll talk about next time.
Yeah.
But one of the things is blank verse, and we did this already. Where did we do this already?
You'll have to remind me. Sadly, I am not the my perspicacity has failed me on this one.
It starts with a Milton.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Okay. So blank verse is unrhymed iambic pentameter, and it was the verse form that was really sort of developed for the English stage in the 16th, 17th century. And it really took off among playwrights because it gives you a kind of formal polish without the burden of having to rhyme every damn thing.
Right. So
you can focus on other things like character, you know, and really sort of developing these sort of three-dimensional characters that leap off the stage. Blank verse it was initially the verse of the stage, which was really kind of shabby. On the one hand, it can sound, you know, rhetorically polished. On the other hand, the culture at the time would have considered it, you know, just kind of throwaway junk, right? Because the theater was kind of, it was just low entertainment, no matter how high the entertainment was.
Right, right.
So it was the verse of Shakespeare. And then something happens in the 17th century. It becomes the verse of Milton, right? Remember, we were sort of talking about this, how Milton took Shakespeare's blank verse and then turned it into something else, turned it into the sound of epic, right?
Hmm. Yeah.
So when poets in the late 18th, early 19th century are utilizing blank verse, it tends to be with this kind of double consciousness. It had started as this, I guess, dramatic, this form used for dramatic speech. And yeah. then it becomes the sound of epic. So when we get to something like Tintern Abbey, Wordsworth is going to be using blank verse with that history in mind and directly alluding to Milton with, you know, the contents of the poem itself. But the form is also an allusion to Milton. So that's something to sort of keep in mind there. All right. It's got this lurking Shakespearean context back there, this lurking theatrical context back there, but it's also got this intervention by Milton in the 17th century. A couple of final terms just to keep in mind. Apostrophe. Apostrophe is when you're speaking to a person or object who's not there. And to my mind, apostrophe is going to be one of those things that you want to keep an eye out for in lyrical ballads, because so much of the time when you think that, you know, the speaker is just going on and on and on about their thoughts and feelings, you begin to realize that within the scope of the poem, they're speaking to another person. Mm-hmm. So there's a drama of dialogue. It's just you have to pay attention to know that that is going on. So there's an apostrophe there where someone is being spoken to. And my own sort of take on this, and I'll show you how it happens in Wordsworth or how it happens in Tintern Abbey, is that apostrophe is sort of at the heart of what he's trying to do with his poetic project. Like, he's trying to connect beyond the page in this virtual reality kind of way. So pay attention to when the poem is speaking to you or speaking to another person, but addressing the second person, right? Mm-hmm. You have an in-stopped line where the grammar of the sentence stops at the end of the line. And then you have an enjambed line where the grammar extends to the next line. We were talking about this when we were talking about Milton, because for Milton, enjambment was indicative of the kind of seemingly chaotic and yet structured nature of nature as God willed it, where you don't have an artificial stopping point, but extend the sense into the next line, right?
Yeah.
So it becomes this rough hole. Wordsworth is going to do some of the same, most likely inspired by Milton. You have a caesura, which is a grammatical pause in the line. So say in the middle of the line, you've got a period. Yeah, that would be a caesura or a stop in the line. You have a metaphor, which is – do you know what that is, Daniel?
I do. The metaphor is what comes after the for in the works of Aristotle. Huh? You like that one?
I do.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I think metaphor as generally used a literary device of I was gonna say comparison, but that also includes simile.
No, it's a comparison. A comparison that does not use like or as, and a simile is a comparison that does use
like or as. Yeah. Is simile considered like a species of the genus metaphor, or are they considered separate literary devices?
No, they're two different things. Okay. And you can think about it. I think poets try to be conscientious about this, because there are two things that you can do that each have their own moral weight.
Yeah.
Or their own ethical weight. When you say, when you use a metaphor, what you're doing is eliminating the boundaries between terms.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. So one thing becomes another.
Right. It's an act of equation. Yeah. Rather than
yes.
comparison. I gotcha.
Yeah. And when you're using a simile, you're drawing things into comparison, but still keeping the boundaries there in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And when I say that there's an ethical or a moral weight to that, what I have in mind is something like Sylvia Plath's Daddy. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but that's one where Plath's father died when I think she was 8. Mm-hmm. He thought he had cancer and it turns out he was diabetic. So, you know, go to the doctor.
Yeah.
But, but like that was sort of like one of the original traumas in her life. And, she always sort of traced a lot of her issues back to that with psychoanalysis and things like that. And so she has this poem that is really sort of an exorcism of that trauma. And it's also a sort of self-analytical move to see how she tried to fill that void in her life with her ex-husband who had just left her. And so it's sort of like revisiting that trauma or reenacting it. And it's a really rough poem because it's sort of like she's throwing everything but the kitchen sink and then she hurls the kitchen sink at her father. But it's just a rough poem to read and it's really hateful, spiteful, and so angry and intense. It's really kind of amazing in its own right, but she breaks decorum. Her father was, I believe, of German descent. And this was written in 62 or 63, where, you know, the full scope of the horrors of World War II were really sort of coming out. The full scope mm-hmm. of the concentration camps was coming out. And in the poem, she literally says, "You are a Nazi, I am a Jew." She's using metaphor there.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, how dare you?
You know?
It's a conflation of terms that carries. I mean, she does more than break decorum. I mean, she's being, I think, purposefully offensive. You know,
yeah.
And it makes you feel the weight of when someone actually uses metaphor in that way, right?
Yeah.
In not to go extraordinarily grim tonight, but there's another poem by the contemporary poet Jory Graham called From the New World, mm-hmm. which is about the poet trying to write a poem about what is it? It was an actual case. I think they made a documentary about it recently of this guy in Detroit who was, I guess he was in his 80s, excuse me, but he was accused of being a former concentration camp guard who got away and then went on trial in Israel. And one of the sort of atrocities associated with him was, and this is absolutely horrible content warning for this, mm-hmm. A 13-year-old girl who had walked out of one of the gas chambers asking for her mother and then being ordered to be taken back in and raped on the way. Graham writes this poem about, you know, okay, if we're going to be serious, then art needs to confront these things and have something to say about these things. And she keeps writing, but what is this like, right? Like, what is the simile? What is the comparison that you can make to that, right? How can trope account for that kind of atrocity? And she ends the poem by breaking off, like what? Like what? There is no comparison to that. Like that, mm-hmm. that singular atrocity has to stand as it is. That person's trauma, that person's pain has to, you have to honor it in that way. you can't compare it to something else, and you certainly can't turn it into a metaphor for something.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So sorry. That's my long, boring ramble for, you know, why the difference between simile and metaphor matters.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
When you break down the boundaries between two things and say that one thing is the thing, then you're making one kind of move of equation. If you're going to say that one thing is like the thing, then you're going to keep things apart to some degree, but there may be some gain in having that separation.
Hmm. Yeah.
So then we get to free verse, and free verse is not going to be something that our English romantics are really going to embrace when we get to Walt Whitman in America. There you go. But free verse, I just felt the need to bring it up because we're talking about metrics. Free verse doesn't have a fixed meter. That doesn't mean it doesn't have a meter. That doesn't mean you can't scan a line by Walt Whitman. It just means it doesn't have a fixed meter or a regular meter.
Yeah. Right?
So you can do whatever you want with the line. And then we come to this word that is in the title of the book that we're looking at that causes me no small amount of consternation: lyric.
Hmm.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. lyric is – fuck it. I don't know what it is. And at least I'm in good company.
You know, lyric means pretty and enjoyable, right?
Well,
to describe, okay. Well, I mean, I'm just thinking like, well, you know, I'm thinking of the times that I, you know, in a usage of the term like lyrical, right? I'll use that when describing prose that is particularly pleasing or affecting in a kind of, I don't even necessarily want to say lighthearted way, but somewhere in that wheelhouse of it be like, you know, I mean, I can read some prose that is dealing with some very profound and sad things and find it very moving. But that's not something I'd be moved to call lyrical exactly. So there is some kind of inflection of sunniness there. And honestly, like thinking about it, I'm sure that's going to be one of those things like how the word romance comes to mean sort of has this erotic meaning to us, or at the very least.
Yeah.
Like a, you know, some sort of element of erotic to it, when really all the word means is just, you know, vulgar Latin. and there's a whole chain of associations that goes back to that. But
yeah, that kind of gets at it, because it's a word that I guess outside of the realm of academia suggests musicality.
Yeah.
At its simplest term, at its simplest, it suggests musicality. But when we use it to talk about a poem, after the 19th century, it gets funky. All right. So the way it's been used critically in the 20th century is typically to signify a short, quote unquote, emotional observation.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, it just meant that it was associated with accompaniment, like it had musical accompaniment. The guy who sort of made an intervention here was John Stuart Mill, who had these, he did a couple of essays where he was talking about aesthetics and he was talking about art, and he was writing in the wake of the Romantics. And he says that, the lyric is a private utterance overheard. And that really sort of articulated a particular view of what the Romantic poets were doing. Here's why what he says is embraced, and here's why it's problematic. On the surface, it does really sort of seem to account for this way that a lot of the Romantics were trying to bridge the gap between public and private.
Yeah, yeah.
Th- there's a presumed intimacy when you're reading the book, right? Like every first day of my intro to lit classes, you know, I ask my students to read a poem and tell me what it's about. And 90% of them say, well, it's the poet's thoughts and feelings. Tells me fucking nothing. Look,
right.
you can spit on the sidewalk and it'll express your thoughts and feelings.
Yeah.
You know, so, but that's the kind of way that we've been taught to believe these are the intimate, private thoughts and feelings of the poet. Well, that misses the fact that you have a speaker in the poem. The poem may be drawn from actual experience, but you have a speaker in the poem. You have this sort of like technique that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. And it misses the kind of rhetorical moves that I think the Romantics were aware they were making. It misses the different genres that they were writing in that I think we were sort of talking about last time. You know, Wordsworth wasn't the first person to write poems about, you know, the local madwoman or the peddlers around town or the beggars or what have you. He wasn't the first person to do that. And certain kinds of genres about rustic life were already developed or developing.
Yeah. Right?
So this reading of everything as private utterance overheard misses the genres that they were sort of writing in. It misses the rhetorical moves that they're making. I mean, it completely misses what he's doing in Tintern Abbey. But it becomes the kind of de facto way of thinking about how a poem functions in the 20th century, right?
Yeah,
or in the 21st century even. Like when you go remember back when there were bookstores and you could go to a bookstore and sort of browse and you pick up a book of contemporary verse and automatically assume this is the true experiences of the author, you know, bled down on the page. That misses all of the kind of complicated interaction between poem and reader that they have devised. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a problematic way of approaching things, but now I'm going to make it even more problematic because I'm going to, you know, call in a problematic critic. Paul de Man, who is a deconstructive critic at Yale and who was later revealed posthumously to have written for several Nazi rags back in his youth in Belgium, and who also sort of conned the academic establishment into believing that he had credentials that he didn't have. Huh. And who apparently, the list of de Man's bad behaviors just goes on and on and on and on. And, you know, one major strike against him, he was a deconstructivist, which he wasn't doctrinaire. It was just some of the things that he was doing really dovetailed with the more doctrinaire stuff that Derrida was doing. And they really sort of hit it off intellectually speaking. And I believe they were friends. But anyway, he has this analysis of the genre of lyric where he basically says that it's not a genre. Mm-hmm. It's become more of a social expectation for a particular kind of reading. And as much as I think this guy is a guy who I want to keep as far as from my family as possible, which I guess is easy because he's dead now.
Yeah.
I have to give it to him because that's a hell of an insight. As far as I can tell, lyric is not really – it's a cultural expectation in the 20th and 21st century more than it is an actual genre or mode. You follow?
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But to take that back to the 19th century, you know, the question I still have is what were Wordsworth and Coleridge thinking when they were thinking that the ballads they were writing were lyrical.
Yeah, yeah.
And then why lump all of these other forms? You've got tons of odes. You've got blank verse. You've got a handful of ballads. And you've got these long kind of narrative poems. Hell, you've got the Rime of the Ancient Mariner, which is anything but a ballad.
Yeah.
So, like, what were they thinking when they were calling these things ballads? And what were they thinking when they were calling them lyrical ballads?
Yeah.
That's something that I really want to take up next time. And that's where I kind of want to leave off tonight.
Yeah.
But,
wow. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I've monologued at you, but do you think you have a clear idea?
Well, that's all right, man. This is one of those episodes, and it's one of those, I mean, this is, I think we're at a point in the project where I'm very much a student right now. And, you know, to be fair, I'm a non-traditional student. I will be sassing back, but like, it really is like, you know, I'm not fooling when I tell the audience, like, I'm pretty out to sea on poetry, but I really, really want to learn more. And it's one of those, I think it's one of those topics that is so, okay, right. All right. Everyone's going to think I'm ridiculous for this, but hear me out. I think with poetry, you have a situation similar to how people approach Steely Dan. And I am going somewhere with this. In that there's, you know, there's the kind of first blush. And I've been very guilty of this where there's simply a kind of not knowing. Well, I mean, like you said, like we're approaching this how to read a poem, right? So like Steely Dan, at first blush, you listen to it, it sounds like some smooth jazz bullshit, right? It's got these saxophone solos. You got the bar chimes going. It's embarrassing. Why would any, you know, why would anyone be caught dead listening to it, right? But you listen closely, but you pay attention to it, and what you get instead of just, and yes, it is smooth jazz bullshit. That's there too. That's important also. But it's a musical style done and kind of in the service of very complicated explorations of things like chords and chord changes and little touches added and moments of masterful artistry, really masterful artistry that are thrown in there that if you're listening to it, like just, you know, if it comes on in the dentist's office, of course you're not going to walk away thinking you listen to something great. But, and again, people feel free to pelt eggs at me. If you sit and listen to with high quality headphones, a lot more texture comes out. A lot more of the texture and the artistry that goes into it comes out. And I'm excited to do with poetry what I spend my time doing with Steely Dan.
No, I think that's an apt comparison that it goes with appreciation that, you know, you have to be able to take it and, well, want to expose yourself to it, first of all, and then to approach it in a way that allows you to appreciate it or not, as the case may be. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I hope this has been educational. I hope we didn't get bogged down in things. I hope that, you know, somebody gets something from this. But we just thought it might be helpful to have some kind of roadmap here before we jump straight into, you know, a book of poetry. Basically, two books of poetry, just an initial book revised, right?
Yeah, and yeah.
So it'll probably be helpful to have some of these terms on the table as we move through and sort of analyze what they're doing. So, well, on that note, stay tuned for our first full read of lyrical ballads.
Yeah.
And just if anybody's reading along, do your best with the original Ancient Mariner. It's a wild ride, dude.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that because I have read The Rime of the Ancient Mariner as included in a Norton anthology, and I'm presuming that's not the original version. So I'm excited to see what was left on the cutting room floor.
Oh yeah, that was the cleaned up version. He really went out of his way to try to ape a kind of mock old English sound and diction. He's following Coleridge is following Spencer's Fairy Queen in doing so. Oh wow.
Yeah.
Because Spencer invented a kind of mock medieval writing.
Yeah.
He's using all kinds of archaisms and neologisms that sound like archaisms. and Coleridge is kind of doing the same thing with Rime of the Ancient Mariner, but it's a weird ghost story about a dude who shoots a bird and then ends up a zombie in the Arctic. So
hey man, I'm all for it. We'll take a dive into that and
Sorry, in Antarctica, excuse me.
Oh,
they went south.
A polar region somewhere, we can say.
Yeah. All right. So I guess everyone is set up as they can be, and we'll just conclude it at that. All right. Enjoy.